So last time we discussed some important points related to some of the practical aspects of meditation, like sitting, posture, and the positioning of our mind, and all the details. We have just two more classes. This is the ninth one, and we'll conclude in the next session. So, I would rather suggest that you put forward your suggestions, or if there are any points that you want me to clarify, explain further, that'd be much better. But before we start our interaction, formal interaction, I will just explain a few more points that we discussed in the last session. So in the 6th chapter, in the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th and 15th verses, the teacher of Gita explains some important points about the practice of meditation. So you find the 10th verse, Yogi yunjita sadadam atmanam rahasisthidaha ekaki yata chittatma nirashihi aparigraha. It's a very important point we discussed. One important word used in this verse is rahasi, means in solitude, where you should be alone with yourself. In fact, this is one important aspect of any kind of spiritual practice, not only meditation, even in prayer also. Any kind of spiritual practice, if done in complete solitude, it will be much more effective, and it will have the effect of starting our spiritual journey inward. So two words are used here, rahasi and ekagi. One should be alone and one should be in solitude. So one practical problem which is often discussed in congregational religion is, in congregational spiritual practices, we are aware that we are not alone and we are in the company of many other people. So very often it could become formal, and the more formal it becomes, the more mechanical also it becomes. And if our spiritual practice, whether prayer or meditation, if it becomes formal and mechanical, it becomes less sincere and less effective. That is one important point. That's why many commentators, especially those who are inclined towards the devotional school of philosophy, no Vedantins, they give a lot of importance to these two terms. One is in absolute. Rahasi means it should be secret. That's the real meaning. But it doesn't have any negative connotation. It means nobody should know that you are praying. Nobody should know that you are meditating. That is one important point. But this is not possible for a beginner. For a beginner, he or she may have to make use of external help, external symbols. We need a symbol, something which is external, so that we can withdraw ourselves from all other external distractions. See, if we can have one external symbol of concentration or focus, then that external symbol of focus or concentration acts as a help in diverting our senses from other external objects. Because diverting the senses and mind, senses of perception and mind, from external objects is the first step in meditation. As I already explained earlier, the five senses of perception, the eyes, which are the most powerful, Because when we see something, any visual object which we see, identifying ourselves as the one who is seeing the object, immediately it will produce a tendency or impression in our mind. Some residue will be created by any object that you see. Because the same object we would see again, not with eyes, but with mind. So, that becomes an object of distraction. So also ears. Ears also become a source of trouble when ears drag the mind away towards objects which are producing noise or voice. I explained this earlier. When our mind and eyes come together, we see an external object. And then, when we close the eyes, we continue seeing the same object, but in a subtle way, at the mental level. And this is what happens in memory and in dream. We continue seeing the same object with eyes. But in dream and memory, we are repeating this visual experience at the mental level. But when we really see something with your eyes open, this experience takes place at the gross level. So mind is drawn towards that visual object. The same thing happens when you hear something. Ears and mind come together and they travel towards the object which is producing the noise, and mind is also directed towards it. And then maybe after some years you may hear the same noise, but not at the physical level, at the mental level. When you remember hearing a noise, we are actually re-experiencing the act of hearing it. But the hearing takes place at the mental level, not at the sensory level. That's why you are able to learn music. You may hear a song today and may remember next year. You may just hear once. There are people who can retain in their memory what they hear just once. They are able to retain. So, what is meant by remembering a sound? Rehearing. But not at the physical level. Sound waves do not travel towards the ears, at the mental level. So also with regard to the sense of touch. Mentally, when we re-experience, we are again reliving the same experience, re-experiencing the same thing. And again, smell, touch, taste, all these things. Even the taste of some good food that you have eaten last year, you may recollect today, then you are re-tasting, not with your tongue. Tongue is there, but it's a mental tongue. Mental eyes, mental ears, mental touch, mental taste, everything mental. So, it is said that mental distractions are much more powerful and much greater impediments and obstacles than physical distractions in meditative life. See, you must have heard about Buddha. See, Buddha, you find in Buddha's life, there is a famous book written around the 2nd century AD. It is written by a great Buddhist scholar, Ashwaghosha. The name of the book is Buddha Vijaya. That is the first book, the first biography of Buddha, 2nd century AD. And later till now, a number of books are written. In all these books you find, Buddha had to confront some obstacles when he was meditating. Means, whatever he had seen, whatever he had heard during his previous years, he remembered. Then maybe there are some serious students who may pose a question. There are many things, many tendencies, many characteristics in human character that you can't explain in the light of experiences in this life. We cannot do that. There are certain inherent tendencies which every human being possesses. He can't behave in a different manner. Certain inherent tendencies and impressions. Now, Vedanta and Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, both are unanimous in explaining this problem. They say, when you recollect your previous experiences belonging to this life, you recollect, you remember them along with ideas, name and form. So ideas related to the previous experience, related to this life, and name and form. See, when you have, if you have seen a tiger, maybe when you were a small kid, today you may remember, the shape of the tiger. And if it had a name, the name also. So the idea, the impression of seeing a tiger with its name and form, these three come together to the mental horizon and you remember. But if there are some tendencies which are deep-rooted, which are inherent, which you can't explain, with the hypnotist may not be able to explain by regressing the patient to the early years of memory formation, then according to Vedanta and yoga psychologists, this has to be explained in the light of experiences in previous life. Otherwise, how could one behave in a particular manner and not in any other manner? You can find. But experiences related to previous life are remembered, relived, just as ideas and not in association with name and form. That's the only difference. Otherwise, there is no distinction. So mind is nothing but a reservoir. It's a bag of tendencies, impressions, residual factors related to our actions, words, thoughts, everything. Now, for a beginner, he or she needs a focus, a point of concentration, an external symbol towards which all his external or outward going senses can be diverted. So that spiritual person may have to make use of sacred books, sacred places, maybe the company of fellow spiritual aspirants. But as we go further and further, one should be able to enjoy the blessing, the blissfulness of solitude and being alone, along with one's own reality, Atman. For a devotee who believes in God, he can believe he is alone with God. For an aspirant who is a spiritual seeker, Vedantist, he can say, well, I am alone with myself because I am the Atman, I am the consciousness, which is the immanent reality, which is the omnipresent reality. Therefore, these two terms are used here. One is he should be alone and he should be in a state of absolute solitude. And then we discussed a number of points last time. He should choose a very clean place. He should have a proper seat. And then he should sit with his body, head and neck in a straight line. And this is sometimes called a proper physical posture. This is, of course, somehow this is hinted at Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, Yoga philosophy, that a proper asana, it is called. Asana doesn't necessarily mean yogic postures. Yogic postures can help us to attain the physical fitness which is necessary for us to sit straight and in a relaxed mode and for a long time. So the body, neck and head should be in a straight line. But when you sit like that, you should not feel that there is an effort involved. If you feel, well, there is an effort involved, it is a physical effort, then that posture is not correct. Maybe in the beginning, one may have to reach this level of physical fitness with the help of yogic postures. But after attaining that, one should completely concentrate on sitting like that. So when you sit for meditation, you should not feel that there is any physical effort involved, no strain. That's why it is said sukha means relaxed. You should feel a pleasure, a joy, an effortlessness, a natural effortlessness when you sit in that posture. And then you should be able to sit for a long time. In the later verses, I already mentioned last time, Sri Krishna, the teacher of Gita, mentions a few very important disciplines with regard to food, actions, activities, etc. All this we have mentioned last time, but it's related to this. Now, how to feel relaxed, restful when you sit? Body should not feel, or rather, you should not feel that you have a body. That is the sign. See, so Krishna makes an interesting statement. Yukta ahara viharasya yukta cheshtasya karmasu yukta sukma avabodhasya yogu bhavati dukha. Very interesting point. He says, one should practice moderation in eating, in sleeping, and in all activities. You should never go into extremes. So, feasting is as bad as fasting. Or fasting is as much an obstacle as feasting for a spiritual seeker. Because if one feasts, obviously we know very well, it creates problems for the stomach. And stomach will remind us, well, I am existing here. When there is any problem in stomach, suddenly you are reminded by the body that it exists there. Your purpose in spiritual practice, in meditation, is to go beyond body consciousness, to go beyond body awareness. The moment body asserts itself, its existence, by saying, well, I am here, if there is any stomach problem, suddenly mind goes towards the body. So the existence of body suddenly becomes obvious. So if one feasts, that also leads to distraction, because mind is brought down to the level of the body. And if one fasts, if you are hungry, if you are thirsty, if you are fatigued or tired, then also body asserts itself. It reminds you of its existence. So in the yoga philosophy, which dates back around 9th century BC, the great philosopher Patanjali makes a statement that one should have complete control of the body. That's a term used in Sanskrit, but the idea is this: you should reach a state where you are not aware of the fact that you have a body. That is transcending body awareness, body consciousness. So feasting and fasting, extreme asceticism is detrimental, is a great obstacle in the practice of yogic meditation. The extreme gluttony also equally an obstacle. And then another point that is mentioned here is one should not be hyperactive and one should not be lazy. If a spiritual seeker is always active, he can never practice meditation. He or she can never practice meditation. Because a fatigued body will drag mind to the bodily level. Mind will never go beyond body awareness. So that's the problem. Because body is tired. And again, if one is always after some work or other, is a workaholic, can't remain quiet even for a minute, then all ideas related to work will come to the surface of the mind when we try to meditate. So one should not be a workaholic. At the same time, one should not be lazy either. Laziness also creates problems. It also dulls, in fact, it deadens the mind. It benumbs the mind. Mind loses its alertness. Because in meditation, one should reach a state of perfect awareness and alertness. But there is no exhaustion, there is no effort. One can be aware of something in waking state normally. We are aware of many things, but there is an effort behind. When I see an object in front of me, when I try to analyze it, then I'm aware of its existence. If I see a picture, but along with this awareness, there is also an effort behind it. Awareness. If we can combine awareness and effortlessness, that is the state of meditation. So, one should not be glutton, and one should not be a practitioner of extreme asceticism. And again, in action and also in inaction, a spiritual seeker, one who tries to meditate, should practice moderation. So, that's a very important point which is mentioned again and again. Now, again, there is a famous verse in the 6th chapter. I was referring to the 19th verse, those who are interested. There it is stated, the mind of a yogi who tries to meditate will be like a lamp, like a flame of the lamp, which is kept in a windless, still, tranquil place, where there is no wind blowing. There is flame, that the flame doesn't waver. It remains steady. Because whatever happens around doesn't distract the mind of a yogi. And if one can reach this level of meditation, Lord Krishna says, the teacher of Gita says, one attains a state of perfect blissfulness, which is called extreme joy, a state of extreme joy or happiness. I already explained this earlier, but I can repeat. A state of blissfulness. It is not just a state of happiness in the ordinary sense of the term. Because happiness, as we understand it, is nothing but a state of the absence of unhappiness. When we try to get something, when we attain it, we feel a contentment or satisfaction. But then the joy or satisfaction that is associated with attaining something empirical or material is relative. Because anything that we attain at the material level, any material objects which gives us satisfaction, it will vanish one day. One day it will be lost. So that joy, that happiness is peripheral, it is temporary, it is not eternal. It is just the other side of unhappiness. Because before we get that kind of joy, there was unhappiness. And that joy will not last for long because the object we get, the object of material pleasure that we get, will be lost one day. It is not eternal. So it is not real bliss. It is only relative happiness or unhappiness. Now here the teacher of Gita says, when you start meditative process, slowly you feel you reach a state of perfect blissfulness, which is called the ultimate joy, the state of ultimate joy. Ultimate, that adjective is very important, because that joy never ceases to be. It is eternal. Because along with this spiritual attainment or blissfulness, we also feel, well, there is something, well, there is nothing beyond this. You also feel there is nothing beyond this which I have already attained. If it is something material, you will always feel, well, one day it may be lost. There is something, if you get money, you may say there is still more money, status, more status, and so on. But when a yogi or when a practitioner of meditation reaches the highest level of inner bliss, he or she feels that there is nothing more to be attained. There is nothing more to be sought after. It gives a kind of feeling, well, I have reached my goal in life. This is called contentment. Along with contentment, other material things can be added. But a person who has got this spiritual contentment can live in this world with perfect happiness and joy, which are never lost, which are eternal. And then, towards the end of the verse, which I already explained some time back, but that's very important. So, that's an important discussion about what happens to a spiritual practitioner who practices this spiritual sadhana or meditative practice. The disciple in the Gita, Arjuna, asked a question. I already said in the beginning, the Gita is in the form of a dialogue between a great teacher and a great disciple. So when Lord Krishna, the teacher, explained different aspects of meditation, Arjuna puts a question to the teacher. What happens to somebody who tries to meditate and practices hard for many years, then before attaining his or her goal, he or she passes away. The spiritual seeker passes away, or he has a fall, he has a deviation from the spiritual path. You can have a deviation by the force of social circumstances or whatever may be. Or one may perhaps die before attaining the supreme goal. So Arjuna puts a question. What will be the fate of a spiritual seeker who fails to attain the goal in this life? Now here one important point to remember is, in Vedantic tradition, life is not just one. It is not a straight line progression. Life is conceived as a cycle. It's not that you have just one life, one opportunity. If you fail in this life, you are lost once for all. If you do well, you will go to heaven. If you don't do well, you will go to hell. Such ideas are found in some of the mythological literature, but not in the philosophical literature like Upanishads, Gita, and so on. So, in Vedantic tradition, human life is conceived as a cycle. We are born, and when we are born, we inherit certain tendencies, certain impressions, certain characteristics from our activities in previous life. And according to the type of residual tendencies and impressions we have inherited, we act and live in this world. And then when we die, this death is not the end of the journey. Death is only just something like a coma or a semicolon. It is not a full stop. After death, this individual soul is born again. So whatever good actions, including meditation or spiritual practices, that we perform in this life will never be lost. So even if you hear once great ideas about liberation, spiritual enlightenment, spiritual unfoldment, if you hear once, or if you read one book or one page from a book, and if that is the only opportunity that we get to, that's the only contact we have with these sublime ideas, even that will not be lost. Along with other residual impressions and tendencies, this also will be accumulated. And in next life, or maybe after next life, when there is a happy circumstances, set of circumstances which are conducive to spiritual life, we will be able to begin. We will be able to continue the spiritual effort, spiritual journey. That's why sometimes you find when you read a book, when we suddenly feel drawn towards this. I have given the example of one great spiritual seeker. He was a disciple of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, Swami Vivekananda's guru. This man was a highly educated man in the later half of 19th century, maybe the last decade of 19th century. This incident happened. So one day, because of his domestic problems and a number of other controversies, he was living in a huge family, so many members, in joint family system, 19th century, later, the last decade of 19th century. He decided to commit suicide. He decided to put an end to his life. And he left his home at around midnight with his wife. And it moved around the city of Calcutta. Midnight. Somehow he had, after traveling several miles in a hackney carriage, he happened to land in the house of a friend, and there he lived. And then from there again he moved to, because that friend didn't want to welcome him at that odd hour, he moved away from there and then went to his nephew's house. There he lived. Next day he started wandering about the city of Calcutta. That's with the bank of the river Ganga, and in a temple on the bank of the river, the great sage Sri Ramakrishna was living, the teacher of Swami Vivekananda. So this man, his name was Mahendranath Gupta. He was the chronicler. He was the one who recorded all the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, which is known today as the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. So this man, along with his nephew, wandered about the banks of river Ganga, and happened to come to the Dakshineswara temple. And they stood right in front of the small room in which Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa was instructing his disciples. So he heard noise and suddenly he felt, who is this person? He is speaking some wonderful spiritual truths. Anyhow, he went to the temple and just paid obeisance and he left. But then he found there's a strange attraction towards some of the words which this great sage was uttering. Next day he came again, and later this person became a great disciple of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. He was the chronicler. He was the one who wrote down Sri Ramakrishna's teachings. every day, whenever he visited Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, he used to write in his diary all that he had heard from his master. Now, he was not visiting the temple every day, but whenever he visited, he closely listened to whatever Sri Ramakrishna was telling and he wrote down. Now, this man, how did it happen? He just wandered about the banks of the river, came to the temple which he had never visited earlier, and happened to hear this great sage speaking or instructing his disciples, and he felt drawn towards it, and he became a great disciple. You may call it an accident. Well, there is a school of philosophy, even accidentalism, you know. You don't look for a cause in India. Two schools of materialism, accidentalism and naturalism. Well, from one angle, you can just interpret it as just a kind of accident. But such things do happen. So, whatever little spiritual practice we undertake in this life will not be lost. That's a great promise which the teacher of Gita gives to the entire humanity. So it's, you are never late, and whatever you do which is good will not be lost. So Arjuna asked this question. Don't you think that a person who undertakes his spiritual journey in this life and who fails to attain anything and who just gets deviated from his path will be lost once for all, like a bit of cloud which gets separated from the mass of cloud floating in the sky? It's a comparison he gives in the 38th verse you find in Gita. Kachinnu bhavi brashta chinnabhara vivadasyadi apradishto mahabahu vimudho brahmanapadi. This is this verse. I just got it for the interest of those who are those who have booked in them. The idea is this. So, this is my doubt, and you should clear this doubt. Now, Lord Krishna explains how it is that whatever little good things you do in this life will not be lost. So he says, if you continue doing any good deeds, it may be reading a good book, listening to a good idea, praying once, meditating, whatever may be, it will remain in your account. Account means it remain within your own mind. It's the mind which accumulates all this, these tendencies. And the next life, if you continue the same type of good actions by the force of activities of this life, then these good tendencies get reinforced, they get strengthened, and this helps us in moving forward in spiritual life. So, in the 41st verse, Lord Krishna says, those who perform spiritual sadhana, spiritual practices in this life, sincerely, they are born in a family and they are born in a set of circumstances, in a set of social and cultural atmosphere in which they will naturally continue their spiritual effort. So, it is not that God rewards you with something. In Vedanta, God neither rewards you or punishes you. It's a natural process. So what happens? This mind accumulates all these tendencies and impressions. I have to say something about this process of reincarnation and rebirth. Then only we will get a clear picture of this. According to Vedanta, you know, as I said, we are moving along with this cycle. Well, we are part of this cycle. Now, what is an individual soul which is revolving along with this cycle? According to Vedanta, this individual soul consists of 17 elements. The 5 senses of perception, 5 senses of action, and then the five vital energies, mind and intellect, 17. This is one analysis. But in some higher Vedantic books, they give a more expanded, a much more elaborate description. That may make the picture more clear. What is that individual soul which is born, which lives and dies and reborn? Sometimes in some Vedantic books, this phenomenon is explained as a unit of, rather as a combination of 8 units. Well, one is mind, intellect, ego sense, and memory. This is one unit. 5 senses of perception, one unit. 5 senses of action, another unit. So total 3. And 5 vital energies, 4. And 5 elements, total 5. In a way we can say all the senses, memory, tendencies, impressions, this much only you may remember. Plus, a desire to do action, and action itself, and the ignorant feeling that you are this body. So long as you feel that you are this body, so long as you don't realize the fact that you are the Supreme Consciousness, we continue rotating along this cycle. The moment you feel, you realize that I am not just this psychophysical mechanism, I am beyond all this, I am the Atman, I am the Consciousness, I am the transcendental reality, the all omnipresent, immanent reality. When we feel, when we experience, when we realize this truth, we go beyond body consciousness. Then we come out of this cycle of rotation. But so long as we associate ourselves with this body, with the mind and tendencies and impressions, we continue this journey. So it is the ignorance that is the cause of this rotation. But I am here not talking about liberated soul. Arjuna is not asking question about liberated soul. Arjuna is asking a question about spiritual aspirants. So I won't extend this description further. So Arjuna asked the question, what happens to a spiritual seeker who fails to attain his or her goal in this life? So Sri Krishna says, that person will be reborn in a family or in a set of circumstances where he will be able to continue his spiritual journey from where he has left it in this life. That is the answer. Now, again once more I shall explain. What is that entity which goes on rotating along this cycle, this wheel of existence? So long as we are ignorant of the fact that we are the Supreme Atman or Consciousness, that entity we may simply, a simpler interpretation I may say, it is the 5 senses of perception, 5 senses of action, and then 5 vital energies, plus mind and intellect. Now, one may ask the question, you are reborn in your next life, do we think that these senses of action and perception continue to exist even after death? When we are reborn, are we reborn with the old senses of action and senses of perception? No. The idea is this. Tendencies and impressions are transmitted from life to life, not senses. Our hands are gone in this life. Or no ears, so senses of perception like eyes and ears we won't inherit when we are reborn. Hands and feet also we will not inherit because these are senses of action. Then what do we inherit? The tendency to use the ears and eyes will be inherited. So towards which object my mind goes, my eye goes, my natural interest goes, that is the result of accumulated tendencies and impressions of previous life. That's what Vedanta says. So if you have already accumulated a lot of positive, spiritually helpful tendencies and impressions in this life, they will not be lost. You will be born again with those good tendencies and impressions, and you will be born in a set of circumstances, in a family, where you can continue your spiritual life from that stage onwards, from where you have left in this life. Now, the Gita divides people into two categories in this context. There are those who have practiced spirituality, meditation and all that, but still retain a very strong desire for enjoying material comforts. Their mind is not completely turned inward towards, they are not fully focused on spiritual liberation. Sometimes they are interested in spiritual pursuit, sometimes they are interested in something else. So there is a conflict. So Lord Krishna says, for such people, they will be born in a family where their desires will be fulfilled, and where after the fulfillment of their desires, they will be able to continue their spiritual journey to the next stage. And what about those who are advanced souls? Especially great spiritual personalities who have completely given up their interest in material pleasures, who have completely turned to spiritual life. If they die before attaining their goal, so Lord Krishna says, they will be born in families where the parents themselves will be great spiritual teachers. That's why it is often stated, you know, this birth is a complex phenomenon. Parents get the children whom they deserve, and children get the parents whom they deserve. If parents do good things, if they have done good meritorious deeds, then they are blessed with children who have got spiritual tendencies. That's why parentage also is a very, very important role for humanity. So, as part of their preparation for becoming ideal parents, they should practice spiritual sadhana, spiritual practices they should do. Then only those souls who are seeking good parentage will be born to them. So, it is a kind of concordance. Good souls who have done spiritual practices in this life will be looking for parents who are spiritually oriented. And spiritually oriented parents will be blessed with spiritually oriented children. So it is a complex phenomenon. This is an elaborate subject. It's not directly related to this. But this process of rebirth or reincarnation is very elaborately described in Vedantic scriptures and many other scriptures also. It's a complex phenomenon. So the point is this, Lord Krishna says, you whatever little you can practice in this life, go ahead, don't stop. Even if you fail, don't feel dispirited, don't be disillusioned, you continue. So a little practice every day, or a little practice once a while, whenever it is possible. Reading a good spiritual work, sacred book, doing something which is spiritual, spiritually elevating, speaking words which are spiritually elevating, anything which somehow or other is related to spiritual life, even a little bit of it, will not be lost. It opens the road right in front of you, which one day will take you to a spiritual destination. That is the promise which Lord Krishna gives to Arjuna, who asked the question, what will happen if I die before I get illumination? So the answer is completed. And then Lord Krishna in the 43rd verse, maybe to reinforce Arjuna's self-confidence, he says, when tatratam buddhi samyogam labhade paurvadehikam yadadecha tato bhuya samsiddho kurudantara. The idea is this, I already explained earlier. Now, this spiritual person, he has accumulated many good spiritual merits, tendencies and impressions, which he will be able to inherit in his next life. And whenever he finds any appropriate situation, this will become stronger. That's why a spiritually oriented person, a spiritual seeker who has done something good in the previous life, if he goes to a library, if he finds in the library maybe hundreds to thousands of books, but if he finds some books which deals with spiritually illuminating topics, he will be drawn towards it. You can, if you read the lives of some of the American disciples of Ramana Maharshi, that is a very Arthur Osborne, many others. They just heard about Ramana Maharshi, they didn't know where he lived. I have found some books on my ideas, straight away started to India and presented in front. Such things happened. How we understand? Arthur Osborne, perhaps there was no reason. From a genetic point of view, from any other point of view, there was no logic, no rationale for explaining how a person like Arthur Osborne became interested in Ramana Maharshi's Vedanta philosophy. How do you explain it? So, here Lord Krishna says, if the spiritually oriented person who has done something good in this life, if he gets some connection with these spiritual ideas which he had accumulated in previous life, he will have a natural attraction towards it and he will continue his effort again. So it will not be lost. They say paurvadehiya means spiritual tendencies which he had performed when his previous body was living, means in previous life. That's how the spiritual journey continues. So, and then in the 44th verse, Lord Krishna makes another statement. He says, that person is helpless. So if you are spiritually oriented, if you have performed many deeds which are spiritually oriented in previous life, you are helpless. You will naturally be drawn to a spiritual ideas. There is no way out. Even if you try to move yourself away from spiritual current, spiritual culture, you can't do that. So he says in the 44th verse, Lord Krishna says, Purvabhyasena tenaiva kriyadehi avashopi saha jignyasurabhi yogasya sabda brahmadi vartade. The idea is very simple. Lord Krishna says, you become helpless because you have done a lot of good deeds in the previous life. So even if you try to move in the opposite direction, you can't do that. You are naturally, in spite of yourself, you are drawn to a spiritual culture and you reinforce your accumulated spiritual tendencies through fresh activities. So spiritual journey continues. So Lord Krishna says, you have become helpless. You can't but move in that proper direction, which you have yourself prepared through your good deeds in previous life. So here the teacher of Gita gives a complete, is a very, 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 in very emphatic language, he gives a promise, nothing will be lost. Whatever little you can practice, you practice. Go ahead. That's it. That's the end of the. So gradually, as the spiritual seeker, he gets completely cleansed of all negative tendencies and impressions, and he gains perfection after going through several births and rebirths. So whatever little you practice in this life, you feel confident, you should feel confident, nothing will be lost, and you are never late. Even at this moment, if you can practice a little spirituality, that will benefit you in your next life. This is the promise which Lord Krishna gives. It was the end of the sixth chapter. Now we will have half an hour meditation. After that, interaction. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. If there is any topic to discuss. Any subjects?
I don't know how to ask it or articulate it, but Supreme Consciousness is, like you were saying, that anything that we do, in any movement we make, reading a good book or a sacred book or listening to you tonight and hearing your words, that goes into a reservoir, and it's the energy is always there. Is that the universal consciousness, that supreme consciousness, that who directs it? How does it get there?
Oh yes, no, I was just discussing the process of turning our mind away from distractions. See, we realize that Supreme Consciousness only at an advanced stage of meditative process, not at the beginning. But at the beginning, we have many problems while trying to meditate. Mind would face many distractions. That's because there are many conflicting thought currents already accumulated in the mind. That's why when we try to concentrate or meditate, often conflicting thought currents and images and tendencies will come to the surface of the mind, one after another. Now, if we watch this, and we watch and observe and analyze these tendencies, you find they are all related to some action or some experience that we had in our previous life. So whatever activities, whatever mental efforts that we have done in previous life had created these tendencies and impressions. So the moment you try to meditate, they all come to the surface. It's just like when you try to clean up a lake which is dirty, you find when you stir it with a stirring stick, then you find so much of weeds and dirt and feet come to the surface. You are trying to clean it up. But when you start doing it, so much of dirt and feet and weeds will come to the surface. The same thing happens to human mind. Now, so there are all these conflicting thought currents. Many of them may try to create problems for the practice of meditation. Now suppose along with these tendencies and impressions, there are positive tendencies and impressions. Say reading a great book, listening to spiritual talks, or any spiritual practice will naturally create spiritually oriented tendencies and impressions in the mind, which are helpful for meditative process. For example, if you have read the life of a great spiritual personality, or if you have read a good book which you find attractive because there are so many spiritually stimulating ideas in it, and you try to meditate, then you find along with this negative thought currents and tendencies, these positive thought currents also will come to the surface. So So try to fill the mind with positive thoughts, thought currents and tendencies and impressions. And if one goes on accumulating these positive tendencies and impressions, then negative tendencies and impressions will become weak. They will become weaker, and positive tendencies will become stronger. That will help us in meditative practice. Mind is a bag of thought currents and impressions, good and bad. So fill the mind with positive, good thoughts, good ideas, so that negative tendencies and negative impressions will become weak. This becomes strong. That's why in many, many scriptures it is stated that we should try to practice spiritual ideas right in early days. When you are very young, when our tendencies and impressions are getting formed, at that stage one should get familiar with spiritual ideas. That is the... I hope it's clear.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you very much. Thank you for your talk. On a practical level, I've been having trouble sleeping lately, and I meditate 20 minutes in the morning and evening, and I'm tired during the day because I've been having trouble sleeping, so I've been meditating more, but I find that it gives me energy. So, do you have a thought about that?
Meditation gives you energy.
Yeah, and then
yes,
I'm not as tired.
Yes, meditation, it calms the mind, and it gives you full rest. So meditation is the best way to get full rest, because it is the agitating thought currents that in our mind which make our mind restless. So as you advance in meditative process, mind becomes more and more restful, and in direct proportion to that, agitating thought currents also decrease. But as you said, you get more energy. So one suggestion which many great sages have given is, you should not confine your spiritual life to 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the evening. You may get only 20 minutes or half an hour in the morning and evening exclusively for meditative practice. But at other times, even in your workplace or in whatever activities you are involved, try to get mental, try to keep your mind familiar with spiritually helpful ideas, reading books or thinking or pondering over it. So that way, whole spiritual ideas will start spreading over the whole process of our life. That will help us in the meditative process. So even when we are not meditating, when we are working in the office, when we are engaged in different professional responsibilities and duties, even at that time, one should try to orient mind towards spiritual ideas. That's why spiritual life is not... there is no holiday in spiritual life. It's a great statement by Mystique. In spiritual life, there is no holidays. It's 24 hours... So we won't be able to meditate or do spiritual practice 24 hours, maybe a little time in the morning and evening. But its influence should be spread over the rest of the day. That will keep the mind always in a spiritual mood. So that's one. I hope it's clear. In other words, to establish a connecting link between formal spiritual practice, regular spiritual practice in the morning and evening and the rest of the day. There should be a connecting link between. They should not belong to two opposite or distinct watertight compartments. Then spiritual progress is not possible. Suppose we say 20, I shall practice spirituality 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour in the evening, the rest of the time, then spiritual practice is not possible. Even if you do little in the morning and evening, we must try to establish a connecting link between this formal spiritual practice, regular spiritual practice in the morning and evening, and the rest of our activities. That's it.
So Swami, you emphasized trying to, have a focus so that distracting thoughts are less troublesome. But do you in that focus? I mean, people speak of consciousness as, or speak of existence, consciousness, bliss. But do you focus on that, or what? Besides the negative, trying to get rid of the conflicting thoughts, what is your focus?
No, one should, those who are practicing Vedantic meditation, one should try to focus on the Supreme Reality as non-different from ourself. So ultimately, in Vedantic spiritual practice, we are rediscovering our own true nature. We are, right now we think we are this body, we are mind, we are intellect and so on. But actually, these are all changing phenomena. In reality, we are supreme knowledge, supreme consciousness, supreme bliss. And for a beginner, we have to think that this reality is immanent in our own being. Immanent in our own being, indweller in our own being, what do you call antaryami, it's called. So then when we meditate according to the devotional tradition, we can meditate that's God, the indweller, the supreme reality seated in our heart. That's easy. But in Vedantic meditation, we have to look upon ourselves as non-distinct, non-different from this Atman, which is supreme knowledge, supreme bliss and supreme consciousness. So when we meditate upon that, then naturally you feel our mind becomes calm. After all, we are what we ourselves think ourselves to be. Ultimately, we are, or we will become what we ourselves consider, what we consider ourselves to be. So for Vedantic meditation, one should have a very high level of mental concentration and a strong determination. So those who are endowed with these qualities can feed their mind again and again with the idea that I am not this body which comes and goes. I am not this changing phenomenon like the body, mind, intellect and so on. I am the Supreme Atman, the consciousness. That's the reality. That in reality, that is my true nature. All these are superimpositions. That's Vedanta, of course. So once we try to concentrate more and more on the Atman, the reality which is non-distinct from our own true nature, which is in fact our true nature, then mind naturally becomes calm and quiet. Because when we think we are the body, then distraction will come. Because eyes and all the senses of perception are parts of the human body. So the moment we think we are this body, distractions are inevitable. The moment we think we are something which is beyond this body, in fact, this body, mind, intellect, these are all changing phenomena. We are the Supreme Atman, which is immanent and all-pervading reality. Then distractions can be reduced. That's in Vedantic meditation. Is very, I am not the external object which I am seeing or hearing or I am perceiving with my five senses of perception. I am not the senses which are perceiving these things. And I am not the mind which is being dragged by the senses towards external objects. I am not the intellect which is cognizing these things. I am beyond all these, the Supreme Atman. If one gets this full conviction, and if he feeds his mind with these ideas, this slowly bodily distractions, mental distractions, intellectual distractions, all will vanish.
We hear these stories, Swami, of these children placed in these horrific situations in life with these parents, different parents. And so my question to you is...
Excuse me once more, children?
Yes, different children in different situations, some of them horrific situations with parents.
Yes.
So my question to you is, you were speaking earlier of children in ideal situations with parents. Do you see all of these situations with children placed as karmic?
Well, you know, this question will take us to a discussion of free will and human effort. See, this and destiny. These three subjects are related to this topic you have introduced. Free will, human effort, which are interrelated, and destiny. So, human effort and free will do have a role. Because people who have education, who have a sense of proper discernment, can bring up their children properly, in proper situations. So, see, karma theory, which you imply, is not fatalism.
Mm.
This is a very, very important principle. Karma theory is not fatalism. See, if you are the result of your previous actions, then your tomorrow will be the result of what you do today. If your today is the result of the effect of your yesterday, then your tomorrow will be the effect of today. So, karma theory actually tells us that you can make your own destiny. We can make our own destiny. It is not that we are helpless tools in the hands of mighty karma. Karma theory is entirely different from fatalism. Because the moment you become fatalistic, everything collapses. So, karma theory, instead of making us feel that we are slaves of karma, slaves of fate, it should make us feel that we are the masters of our future. Through conscious effort, one can change one's effort. Because the presence of Atman is universal. The manifestation of this divine principle depends upon the medium through which it manifests. We can change, we can convert our medium into something which is effective. We can convert ourselves into effective media for manifestation of this Supreme Consciousness. So that's why in some of the old Vedic literature, Vedantic literature, you find some convocation, you know. Children who have completed education in the Vedic hermitage, forest hermitages, when they are going back to their homes for starting their regular married life, some of the instructions given, Satyam Vada Dharmam Chara Satyana Pramidavyam Dharmana Pramidavyam. In English, you should speak the truth, you should practice virtuousness, you should never deviate from truth and righteousness. And then, Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, Aditi Devo Bhava. The instruction given by the teacher to a young man who is departing the forest school, the hermitage school, to his home to start his life, regular life as an household, is you should respect your parents, mother, father, your teacher, and the guest as much as you honor God himself. It's a bit of a hyperbolic exaggeration, but the idea is you must respect your parents as much as you respect God himself. And then it is stated that parents who give children only physical food and not spiritual food are not real parents. Parents should not only give education and food, but also should give spiritual education so that they will learn these lessons which will help them to become effective members of the family and responsible citizens of the country. This you find in a convocation address in one of the Upanishads. Upanishads is a Vedantic text, Taittiriya Upanishad. And there are many interesting ideas in these scriptures closely related to the sanctity family relationships. A teacher who gives only secular education and not spiritual education is no teacher. A mother or a father who give only physical comforts and secular education and no spiritual education are not parents. Similarly, children who do not pay back their indebtedness to their parents are not ideal children. Such ideas you find in the Vedantic scriptures, closely related to family, the sanctity of family relationships.
So, Atman is the supreme consciousness, which we all have, but we also have...
Which we are all. Yes, yes.
But we also have these bodies, and we also have personalities, and we also have pieces of us that forget who we are. What else does the Gita say about how to wake up and move toward the Supreme Consciousness besides meditation and not being attached to the fruits of your things and having steady wisdom? What else does it prescribe as far as moving from where most of us are to this spiritual Supreme Consciousness?
Yes. But one point you mentioned is the most important one. Doing our duty without any desire for the results of our duty. And see, we can never remain quiet physically and mentally all the time. Even if physically we are not active, mentally we'll be active. Speculations, thoughts, these are also actions. So, do our duty, looking upon our duty and work as an act of worship, if one believes in God, or as an act of service, if you don't believe in God, will help us to keep our mind away from desire for the results of our actions. Now, as I said earlier, it is the desire for the results of our actions that create tendencies and impressions in mind. If we have no desire for the result of what we do, that action will not produce any tendencies or impressions. So,
but we have to have desire for something. If you had no desire, yes, there would be no energy.
Yes, true. So what we must do, at the beginning stage, one should have a strong desire for spiritual emancipation. Because this desire will push aside, remove all undesirable desires. So one great grand desire for liberation, for spiritual enlightenment, will remove all other lower or undesirable desires from our mind. And as we intensify this desire, our desire for other lower things will slowly vanish, so we won't look for the results of actions. And if we can do our work without any desire for the results, these actions will not have any leave any impression or tendency in the mind. And you know, a mind which is free from these tendencies is not mind. It is one with Atman itself. That mind will not go outward. Mind by its very nature is nothing but it's a platform of thought currents which are naturally oriented towards external objects. The moment mind stops going outward, then it is Atman itself. Last time I quoted Ramana Maharshi said, mind turned inward is Atman, because mind can never be turned inward. Mind by its very nature is oriented towards external objects. The moment we are able to withdraw, we are able to stop this mind from going external things, then these thought currents will cease to exist. Then we feel that it is Atman itself. So mind is the name of or the function of impressions and tendencies. Mind is not an entity. It is just one dimension of the function of human impressions and tendencies.
Is there a soul in this thing? This mind is a very confused.
Mind is?
Mind is something that I get confused with ego and with lower kind of thought patterns.
Yes.
And I wonder, is there a concept of a soul in the Vedanta or not?
Yes. Emotions, thought currents, tendencies, impressions, all these constitute the mind. The moment these things vanish, there is no mind. So, and again, the moment we go beyond desire, beyond any kind of desire, then new tendencies and impressions will not be created. It is a desire for something that creates tendencies and impressions. You know? Otherwise, we won't have any tendency. So you find great spiritual personalities, they have done gigantic things. They have done accomplished marvelous things in their life. But calm and quiet. They have no desire. So one can be active without desire. In fact, all the gigantic tasks, great things accomplished by great men in the world were accomplished without desire. I am not talking about great scientists or historical figures. I am talking about great thinkers who have made everlasting contribution to human thought or spiritual tradition. They have absolutely... They have no desire. They have one great desire to do great things for others. But this cannot be called desire. When we use the word desire, there is an element of selfishness attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about desire behind our action, there is always an element of selfishness attached to that desire. But to desire to do something good for others, good for the world, that desire is not selfish desire. Evil people can never be unselfish. You know, you can't say he did so much harm with though he had no desire. But all the gigantic great things were done by people who worked without any desire, any selfish desire. That's what I mean.
Thank you.
Om, peace, peace, peace.